Before we get to that, I'll just make a brief mention about the idea of squeezing of states, or which is how classicality emerges from the quantum. So this is the concept of how it is that we see something classical when what we're actually living in is a quantum state in the context of cosmology. And this is going to be important. This is important. Inflation is that fundamentally inflation, the fluctuations that are generated during inflation are quantum fluctuations, but what we see at late times are just classical fluctuations. Now, there are many different ways to see how classical comes from quantum. Of course, always what you're doing is, in some sense, you want to take h bar to zero or see that the quantum effects are small to get a classical regime. And one of the main difference between quantum field theory and classical field theory is, of course, in classical field theory, the fields are numbers, and therefore they commute. So two fields at different space-time points, x and y, obviously commute. Whereas in quantum theory, these are operators, and in general they don't commute, and they don't commute, and the actual value of them is usually something that scales with h bar. So as we see that as h bar goes back to zero, we go back to the classical condition. So one way to understand how a classical field theory emerges from a quantum field theory is that there must exist some limit in which effectively operators begin to commute again to within a good approximation. And the limit that occurs is called the squeezed limit. And it's precisely the limit in which you have many particles. So by that, what we're going to mean is we're going to take, let's suppose we're on Minkowski space, as before, and we take our modes and we expand them as usual in positive and negative frequency modes, except now we assume that we for some reasons unknown to us at the moment, the actual state is in some Bogoliubov transform of the usual. So I should have put, as usual, I forgot the x of dependence. There's some Bogoliubov transform of the positive and negative frequency modes. And by now, we're familiar with the concept that what this means is when the actual state, so when the actual the state now, the state that's defined by the annihilation from the annihilation operators, but with these mode functions, this is in some sense an excited state where we have a number density of particles per mode k, the unit volume that scales like beta squared. So let's suppose that's the actual state that we happen to be in, and we're not going to ask how we got into that state. So as I said, to have a classical limit, things must approximately commute. So let's consider the following quantity, the ratio of, in this state, 5x, 5y, minus 5y, 5x, divided by the sum, 5x, 5y, plus 5y, 5x. So this thing is obviously defined to be a dimensionless ratio and measures the extent to which these two particular operators don't commute. So the point is that this thing must scale with h bar, because in the classical theory it would just vanish. And so in some sense this is an order parameter that R is approximately 1 in the quantum regime, in the very quantum regime, and R is 0 in a classical regime. So what we want to do is understand in what limit can this thing become very small, and therefore the state becomes very classical. So let's just calculate these guys. So if we do this 5x, 5y, if we do that computation, well, when we multiply phi here acting on this piece here, the only relevant piece is the creation operator. And from this piece, the only relevant piece is the annihilation operator, as usual. So this thing looks like integral d3 k1 over 2 pi cubed over root 2 omega k1, integral d3 k2 over 2 pi cubed 1 over root 2 omega k2. And so from this side, from the x dependence, we have only this piece is relevant. So we have e to the I k dot x. UK x0 that's k1, so k1 for the first one, and from the right we have an a dagger k2 0, and we also have e to the I, and it's minus I k 2 dot y u star k2 y0. Everyone clear on that? This thing is obviously a function of t. So x0 is the time for this one, and y0 is the time for that one. The mode functions depend on time. Yeah, so I'm just using the notation that the 4 vector x is x and x0. And then we do the normal thing. So this thing just gives me a 2 pi cubed times the delta function in k space, which allows me to get rid of one of those delta functions with one of those integrals. And this thing just then becomes 2 pi cubed 1 over 2. Omega k, kind of regret my choice of notation, but never mind, times e to the I k dot x minus y, uk x naught, uk star y naught. This is the Whiteman function, which is the non-time ordered expectation value. It's important not to work with the time ordered quantities because we're actually interested precisely in the difference between the different orderings here. So this difference on the top, all we're doing is we're switching x and y. And when we switch x and y, the sign of this goes the other way around, but then you can compensate that by switching the sign of k in the second dummy integral. So then I just write this as uk star y naught minus uk y naught uk star x naught. So the difference here is just because this one here is complex conjugated on the y naught, whereas here it's on the x naught, and that's the only difference. So this limit, it turns out there's a limit called the squeezed limit. Remember that these things over here, the Bogoliubov coefficients, had to satisfy this relationship just by unitarity, just preserving the norm. So let's suppose you populate your state with many, lots and lots of particles, so many more than one. So in the limit in which the number of particles is much bigger than 1, so it's the density of particles, in some sense this is the number within a unit element in phase space. So when that gets to be much bigger than 1, then this condition basically says alpha k squared is approximately beta k squared plus a small correction. Now you can solve this to say that basically alpha k is essentially up to a phase beta k up to an irrelevant phase, but it turns out that this phase is really irrelevant, and I can always choose the phase to be such that it's unity. So in the limit in which you have many particles for which beta squared is much bigger than 1, then you go to a limit in which the two Bogoliubov coefficients roughly look equal to each other. Alpha is approximately beta. And this thing is called the squeezed limit. And the point about that limit is that now the mode function UKX, essentially you can take out an overall, let me write it as beta, you can take out an overall beta K from here, and this thing is then just proportional to e to the minus I omega t plus e to the plus I omega t. In other words, this is basically 2 beta k cosine omega t. But then by the same token, the complex conjugate uk star is 2 beta star k cosine omega t in this limit. So now if we calculate what's inside this bracket here, then we have exactly 4 beta k mod squared cosine omega k x naught cosine omega k y naught minus 4 beta k squared cosine omega k y naught cosine omega k x naught, because all we did is switch x and y, and so this thing is 0. So in the extreme squeeze limit for which alpha is approximately beta, that's also the limit in which u is proportional to u star, and since it was exactly the difference between u and u star which encoded the lack of commutation, then that limit is also the limit in which these operators commute, and that's the classical limit. So in that limit, the numerator goes to 0, but the denominator remains non-zero, because on the denominator what we have is the sum of this. And so you can really say that beta xy goes to 0 in the limit that beta k is much bigger than 1. So physically exciting a state so that it's filled with many, many quanta, many particles, makes a state look more and more classical. Of course, it's still really a quantum state, and that's why it's called squeezing. You know, this state is still a vacuum state, it's still a quantum state. But nevertheless, when you calculate correlation functions, the answer you get is almost indistinguishable in this limit from what you would have got using a completely classical field theory. And this is precisely what happens in inflation, whereby in inflation you have some finite size horizon, and modes start out defined at sub-horizon scale, so their wavelength is very small, and then they get stretched by inflation, so eventually their wavelength is much bigger than the horizon size. And in the process, when the wavelength gets comparable to this scale, that's the scale at which particle creation occurs. And you get lots and lots of particle creation. So effectively, inflation is a mechanism that gives you beta to be much bigger than unity. So when the modes come back in the horizon again, what you have is a state filled with many quanta, and it looks very classical, even though that it really started out as quantum. Yeah. No, that's it, yeah. It's crucial to have different times here. If they're at the same time, then obviously this is zero. So I could have phrased this in terms of the lack of commutativity of the field and its momentum and done it that way around. So even if we're working equal times, the statement would be we look at the ratio between phi of x and pi of x. And then go through the same argument, and the answer would come out the same.
Yeah. Could you repeat why the beta squared being much, much greater than 1?
So that this condition is approximately true. This is an approximation. Because in that limit, you can neglect. Because secretly, what's going on is there's a H bar here. Right? So the classical limit is always when H bar goes to 0. So it's the limit in which mod alpha squared is mod beta squared. No, of course, we've choose units where h bar is 1, and so we don't see that. But if we hadn't done, that's where it would be. Yeah?
Is this straightforward to show directly that beta squared must start than 1 during inflation? When we do it, we always take it back much after inflation, and then we show particles were created at some point.
Right.
But if we try to do this from,
yeah, that's because the problem is there is, yeah, actually when the modes are well outside, there is no notion of positive and negative frequency at all. And therefore, it's, you know, there's no well-defined number operator. But in some sense, that's the extreme case. You know that the time when you're going to produce most particles is the time in which the notion of positive and negative frequency completely breaks down. So that's what occurs during inflation. So when the modes come back inside the horizon and you have a notion of particles again, then you find yourself in this very highly populated state. Exactly. and you can show this. What you can show is that this is true. Without mentioning particles, you can show that during inflation, this thing really asymptotes in time to zero. It actually it goes, roughly speaking, it goes like an exponential. Like that, so you can really show that the commutators go to zero. Yes. It takes like inflation usually lasts 60 e folds, but you have to ask mode by mode. So you know, so inflation lasts 60 e folds. So here's the end, here's the beginning. But the modes that we see we can only see, roughly speaking, the first 10 e-folds that went outside the horizon, because the modes that first go out are the ones with longest wavelength, and those are the ones that are coming in just now. So that's what corresponds to our current horizon size. And then the CMB is like the first 3 e-folds, and then large-scale structure can see down to here. And then these modes were always just too small to get lost in nonlinear stuff. Why was I saying this? What did you ask again? I've forgotten.
I was wondering if this shows we can treat even inflation classically.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So in fact, it you can show it only takes a couple of e-folds. Essentially because this is exponentially dropping off. So it takes like, as soon as you've had 10 e-folds, this thing is e to the minus 10, and so it doesn't take long for that behavior to set in. Yeah. Yeah. No. I had them in here, right?
Yeah, but what I think is true is that if Kant was a different sign.
No, I did a trick. Sorry, I said it in words without doing it in practice. So it does come in with a different sign, but I can switch the sign with K in the second term to make it come at the same time. I was a bit quickened with that. Yeah. So so you can do that. So you really see explicitly it's just the time dependent factor that determines the lack of commutivity. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So these are it's exactly the same thing as in quantum mechanics. So this the notion of squeezing is one borrowed from quantum optics, and people in quantum optics worry how to make something that looks like a classical state from a quantum state. And what you're doing is the same. If you think about what is going on in phase space, it turns out that what you're really doing, if you look at the space of position and momenta, and you might have some, if you look at the Wigner function, which represents how things are distributed in phase space, you've got some distribution initially that looks like that. But as you squeeze the state, as you make this bigger and bigger, what happens is that it starts to localize on some given trajectory in phase space. And a classical trajectory has some definite line in phase space, whereas a quantum one is sort of spread out. So it's precisely in the squeezed limit that the wave function is less and less spread out along a certain direction in phase space. So it's really the same thing. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a separate thing. Yeah. So, because that temperature is the temperature for the inflaton quanta, whereas the reheating temperature is the temperature of matter. So, yeah. Okay. So now, let's move on to the Unruh effect. Now the Unruh effect. So far we've talked about the fact that in a time-dependent space-time you can create particles, and in some sense that's not so surprising when you recognize that in a time-dependent space-time energy is not conserved, and so it's that lack of conservation of energy that allows you to create particles even when you're in the vacuum. However, the Unruh effect is something that's really much more surprising even than that. And the Unruh effect is the first example, well, I don't think it was the first discovered, but is the simplest example where the notion that the vacuum and therefore the notion of a particle is actually observer dependent. So, and this is even without dependence. Even in a static space, where energy, which of course is associated with the Killing vector d by dt, is conserved, so that there's a well-defined notion of vacuum, which is the minimum energy, is minimum energy. One observer will see that state as completely empty, as the vacuum, whereas then another observer can see it filled with particles. And the Unruh effect is the particular example where a constant accelerated observer in Minkowski space interprets the vacuum as filled with a thermal bath, thermal distribution of particles. And the Unruh effect is essentially the precursor to the Hawking radiation effect. So we'll essentially, when, if you understand the Unruh effect, then you understand 95% of the Hawking calculation. And also it's the precursor to what we're going to see in de Sitter, where you also have the same property that an observer in de Sitter, even not one that's accelerated, but just someone who's at rest, will also interpret the vacuum as being filled with the thermal distribution of particles. And this really is one of the most profound results about field theory in curved space-time. And of course, in the specific case of Hawking radiation, it's that finite temperature that ultimately led to the connection between black holes and thermodynamics, the fact that black holes have entropy, because if they've got temperature, they should have entropy. And that fact is the one definitive piece that we understand about quantum gravity. And so, but ultimately, it all comes down to the fact that there's a temperature here. So let me remind you, in Minkowski space, there are a class of observers which are called inertial observers. Observers, which are the inertial ones. So these inertial observers are those that are traveling at constant velocity relative to each other. So in other words, two inertial observers, A and B, B is just traveling at some constant velocity relative to A. And so in Minkowski space, we know that in order to relate the physics for A and A observer and the physics for B observer, we just do a Lorentz transformation. So inertial observers are related by Lorentz transformations. And we know how that goes. It goes, like, let's suppose we're in two dimensions, it goes something like T prime is gamma T minus Vx. X prime is gamma X minus Vt. Where V is the velocity, the relative velocity between A and V. No, you're right. Is that right? So the Lorentz transformations are a map between different inertial observers, If one guy is at rest, it tells us how to go to the frame of reference in which the other guy is at rest. Now, the point is that the notion of positive frequency, which of course is the crucial notion that we need in defining the vacuum and defining particles, is invariant under this. And the reason is that if you take a mode that's positive frequency, and you do the Lorentz transformation, so you relate k to the new variables, gamma t prime plus phi x prime, then this is really just the same as some Lorentz transform momenta times x prime minus I times a Lorentz transform momenta times t prime, where, for example, omega prime is gamma omega minus vk. But the crucial point is that if we're doing, you know, an orthochronous Lorentz transformation, so one that doesn't change the direction of time, omega maps to an, if omega is greater than 0, it maps to an omega prime that's greater than 0. So positive frequency maps to positive frequency. So this of course means that we don't need to, when we're in Minkowski space, as soon as we define the vacuum to be Lorentz invariant, we didn't need to have any observer dependence in that statement. You know, if it's Lorentz invariant, it's the same for all observers. Everybody agrees. So that's why there's a natural choice of vacuum. But when we go to an accelerated frame of reference, it's no longer true that positive frequency no longer maps to positive frequency. In fact, it's going to map to some mix of positive and negative frequencies. And this is the crucial thing behind. So this means that a state that looks like the vacuum in which you define your creation and annihilation operators relative to these positive frequency modes, here it's going to look like a mix of positive and negative frequency, and therefore you're going to think you're in an excited state, and that's why an accelerated observer is going to see a bath of particles. So to see that, we've got to do that coordinate transformation. So we can no longer do a Lorentz transformation. That only works for constant velocity. But we need to figure out what coordinate transformation do we do to go to a natural accelerated observer's frame of reference. Now, this is a bit more tricky. So to see how to do that, so let's, again, we'll stick in two dimensions to keep things simple. So we've got time and space. So what do we mean by constant acceleration in two dimensions? Well, we've got a particle on some trajectory, x mu, its velocity, its proper velocity is dx mu d tau, and so its proper acceleration, a mu, is d2x d tau squared, where d tau is the proper time. Tau is the proper time along the world volume. So tau d tau is square root dt squared minus dx squared. So by constant acceleration, we're going to mean something that's a notion that's Lorentz invariant, namely that minus a mu is going to be a constant. So here, this is what we really mean by, because otherwise, to say constant acceleration, we're going to need to say what frame we're in if we look at it for a mu. So the best way to say it is for some Lorentz invariant combination, minus a mu. So let's look at the trajectories which satisfy this equation. It's a funny looking equation, square of a double derivative thing, but we want to solve this equation. Well, we can simplify this somewhat by using light cone coordinates, just as you would use when quantizing a string, for example. So in light cone coordinates, so we take the original metric, where you've got a two-dimensional metric, and define, and everyone has a different convention on this, so I'm going to choose to define x plus or minus is t plus or minus little x, and then it's easy to show that this is the same as minus dx plus dx minus. And of course, the surface x plus is 0 and x minus is 0 are null trajectories because it's x plus or minus t. So we're taking our original space and time coordinates and we're foliating it with null rays like that. That's the light cone coordinates. Now, the advantage of that is that, so something else we know is that the four velocity dx mu d tau, if we square that, so by that we mean dx mu d tau, this must give you minus 1. Because that's the definition of proper time. So define the 4 velocity squared must be minus 1. And in light cone coordinates, this is the statement that dx plus d tau, dx minus d tau is equal to unity. Can everyone see that? So this is what makes light cone coordinates advantageous, is that we can just rewrite dx minus d tau is 1 over dx plus d tau. So we can directly solve for x minus in terms of x plus, and then we'll just get one differential equation for x plus. Similarly, the formula for the acceleration, a squared, ends up being d2 x plus d tau squared, d2 x minus d tau squared. So we can plug in what we know for dx minus. So a squared is d2 x plus d tau squared. And then it's d by dt of dx minus, which is 1 over dx plus d tau. This is where I found out that I probably got some signs. Let's see, did I do that the right way around? Bum-ba-dum-ba-dum. So that thing gives you minus d2 x plus d tau squared. And then differentiating this gives you 2 x plus d tau squared over dx plus d tau squared. And this is where I realized that I should have defined that the other way around. Acceleration was this way around. So it was that way. Sorry. Fiddle the signs till it works. So now this equation is just an equation for dx plus d tau, and it's quite simple to solve. In fact, just taking the square root of it, we have that dx plus d tau squared is A times dx plus d tau, or rewriting d tau of log dx plus d tau is A. So the solution of that log dx plus d tau is a constant plus A tau. So dx plus d tau is e to the a tau, and x plus is itself a constant plus e to the a over a e to the a tau. So that's the general solution. And now we just get x minus for free by solving this equation. So dx minus d tau is 1 over this. So it's e to the minus a to the minus a tau. And therefore, x minus is c plus e to the minus a over a. And there's a minus there, e to the minus a tau. So that's the general solution for a constant accelerating trajectory written in light cone coordinates. Now, these things, the B and C, just represent shifts of coordinates. I can always rescale where my origin is to set B and C to 0. So let's do that and just focus on one particular accelerated trajectory so that we can write the somewhat simpler formula, x plus or minus e to the plus or minus a, e to the plus or minus a tau, plus or minus 1 over a. And similarly, the proper time was only well defined up to a constant shift anyway, so I could always rescale tau to include this constant a because it comes in always with the same time. So in other words, I can essentially set a equals 0 by shifting tau appropriately. Is there any questions? Am I going too fast, too slow? Okay. So that's the general solution written in terms of proper time. Let's just write it in terms of real space coordinates. Let's map it back to the T and X coordinates, too, because light cone coordinates are difficult to think about. So T coordinate is a half x plus plus x minus. And I've set A to 0. So x plus plus x minus is going to be 1. We've got half of it, so it's 1 over 2a e to the a tau plus e to the minus a tau, which is 1 over a. I feel like I did this. Yes, thank you. I'm glad you said that because I was going to go very wrong. 1 over a times the sinh of a tau. And x is 1 over x plus minus x minus, which is the cosh. So now it should be obvious we can just rewrite this trajectory as ax squared minus at squared is 1, or x is 1 over a square root 1 plus at squared. So now we've written the trajectory just directly in terms of space-time coordinates. Now, if you just plot out that trajectory, what it looks like in the TX plane, it looks like something like this. So let me draw the light cone. These are the lines x is t, x is minus t. you'll notice that for very large values of t, I can just take the square root of mean at when this is much larger than 1. And so x is precisely t for very large values. And t can switch signs. So in other words, what's happening is that the solutions of that equation actually asymptote at very large times to the null trajectories, x is t and x is minus t. So it looks like that, and then the midpoint here is 1 over a. X is 1 over a. So x is manifestly positive, but t can go positive or negative. And if we had a different acceleration, you get a similar sort of thing. It would always asymptote to the null light cone, but would look like that. Now, this asymptoting to the light cone is the crucial thing that really gives you the Unruh effect. Because what happens is that, let's suppose you've got some observer here who wants to send a signal to our accelerated observer. Well, he can't send any signal faster than the speed of light, which is set by trajectories which are parallel to the light cone here. So no matter what he does, he can never send a signal that crosses that line, so he can never send a signal to our accelerated observer. So that means that this line here is what's called a future event horizon. It represents the horizon. Anything on this side of the horizon is stuff that this observer will never know about. He will be able to influence because he'll be able to send a signal that goes this way and influence this guy's trajectory, but the accelerated observer will never know anything about what lies on that side of his spacetime. So that's called a future event horizon. Similarly, this light cone is a past event horizon. Because if you've got some guy down here, he can send a signal to the accelerated observer, so the accelerated observer can know about the guy here, but the accelerated observer can never himself send a signal back to this guy because he can't send anything faster. He sends a signal, he can't send anything faster than the speed of light, which goes that way. And in this region over here, it goes both ways. You can never the accelerated observer will neither be able to see, nor will he ever be able to send a signal to that region. So there's a kind of half horizon here in the sense that you'll be able to see this guy but not send a signal back to him, and here you'll be able to send a signal to this guy but never see him, and here you'll just completely out of causal contact whatsoever. And it's really the existence of these event horizons. And this is now a well-understood concept, is the existence of event horizons that lead to the notion of temperature and particle, and the fact that an accelerated observer sees particles. So we now understand that the basic reason why you have Hawking radiation is because a black hole has an event horizon. Whenever you have an event horizon, you will have an observer who will see from the event horizon effectively a thermal distribution of particles. Similarly, in De Sitter space, you have a cosmological event horizon, and the same goes there. So in fact, it doesn't matter whether your event horizon is a black hole event horizon or a cosmological event horizon or just an event horizon because you're in an accelerated frame of reference. Whichever one it is, you always have finite temperature associated with that. And that's why all these effects are really very closely connected. But we still haven't achieved what we wanted to do, which was to remember the Lorentz transformation was a way of doing a coordinate transformation to go from a frame in which a given observer is moving at constant velocity to the frame in which it's static. We want to do the same transformation from the frame in which this guy is accelerating to some coordinate system where this line is at constant position. So we actually want to set up our coordinate system to follow these accelerated trajectories, and we're going to set up our coordinates going this way to look like that. So our aim is to set up a coordinate system such that the accelerated trajectory is really one at constant position, and then the time increases with the proper time of the world line of the accelerated observer. And to do that, it's useful to remember that in flat space, so we've written the metric x plus x minus, you can do the nice thing about light cone coordinates is that you can naturally do a change of light cone coordinates. Take one right moving light cone coordinate and take it to be a function of another guy, f plus, and then x minus is f minus of x minus. And under that coordinate transformation, the metric shifts to minus f plus prime, f minus prime, dx plus dx minus, which is therefore conformally related with some conformal factor to another Minkowski spacetime. So for those of you that are familiar with doing quantizing the string, you do use the same trick there. So what we're going to do is do precisely such a transformation to make it so that in the new coordinates, the little x plus and little x minus, it really is the case that a constant point in space is this trajectory and a constant point in time is that trajectory. So we're going to define new coordinates. Let me call them tau is x. Let me call them x plus or minus is tau plus or minus rho. So tau is going to be the time for an accelerated observer. And rho is going to be the space coordinate for an accelerated observer. And so to achieve this, we just do a transformation that exactly mimics these formula, or precisely this formula with the A dropped out. So look at that formula. The thing to guess that's going to work is if we do x plus or minus is 1 over A plus or minus e to the plus or minus A little x plus or minus. And that clearly works because now if you look at a point of constant rho, rho is 0, then x plus or minus are just equal to a tau, just equal to tau. And then this equation is precisely the equation for the accelerated trajectory. So doing this coordinate transformation is precisely what is the necessary coordinate transformation so that every point of constant rho corresponds to an accelerated trajectory in the usual coordinate system. So explicitly what the transformation is ds squared is, so we're going to have an f plus prime. So in other words, what we're saying here is f plus or minus x plus or minus 1 over a, e to the plus or minus a, x plus or minus. So this thing is minus f plus prime. That brings down an a, so we have e to the plus ax plus e to the We have a prime, the minus goes away, so a x minus, and then dx plus dx minus. So that's minus e to the a x plus x minus dx plus dx minus, and that's minus e to the 2a rho d tau squared minus d rho squared, switching back to these coordinates. So the coordinate system for which every one of these lines is a constant rho, and every one of these lines is a constant tau, is that for which the metric looks like d s squared is e to the 2a rho minus d tau squared plus d rho squared. This is called the Rindler coordinate system. And in fact, essentially near every event horizon, a similar such coordinate system can be made. Yep. This one? On the
B to the minus x minus. Why isn't it e to the minus x minus on the bottom? You define the f as e to the minus x minus.
Oh, I beg your pardon. You're right. Sorry, you're right. And that is the correct way to get that answer. Because x plus minus x minus. X plus minus x minus is tau plus rho minus tau minus rho, so it's 2 rho. So this is the Rindler coordinate system. It essentially describes the near horizon coordinate system for any horizon. It's going to crop up in the De Sitter case, it's going to crop up in the Schwarzschild case. And another way to write this is to define R, let me call it capital R, distinguished from the normal R. R is 1 over a e to the a rho. Define that so that then dr is e to the a rho d rho, so that then this metric is equivalent to dr squared minus r squared d tau squared. That's another way of writing the same coordinates. Now we're running out of time, so we'll carry on the discussion tomorrow, but you can already see the origin of the thermal distribution that you're going to see. The origin is as precisely as you learned before. If you take a metric, if you find that that metric is periodic in Euclidean time, then the periodicity in Euclidean time is precisely associated with 1 over the temperature. Now this metric here, if you go to Euclidean time, so you say tau is I tau Euclidean, this is just two-dimensional flat space. But this geometry has to satisfy a property that if you set a field on that geometry, then you know that it's only smooth if it's periodic. So I dropped an A somewhere, didn't I? Somebody should have told me in that coordinates. It was there, A squared. This geometry is only smooth in Euclidean space if the fields are identified in Euclidean time by an amount tau e goes to 2 pi over a to tau e plus 2 pi over a. And the basic reason is that is if we take a smooth geometry, Cartesian geometry, and you map it, into spherical polars, then you know that because of that mapping, you get something like tan theta is x over y. You find that the range of theta goes from 0 to 2 pi, because it's the range of tan. And then as you go around 2 pi again, you don't get a new solution anymore. So a smooth geometry, one that's locally Cartesian, has to be periodic in the angular direction by 2 pi. So similarly, this geometry could be smooth in Euclidean space, has to be periodic. So then this geometry is periodic under tau, goes to tau plus 2 pi I over A. And then you learn, if you have things like e to the I tau, and you shift that by tau goes to tau plus 2 pi I, this picks up an e to the minus 2 pi e over A. And this thing looks precisely like a Boltzmann factor, e to the minus beta e, where beta is 1 over kt times 2 pi over A. And so we're going to infer by the standard argument that the temperature is exactly A over 2 pi k. A, remember, is the acceleration, so a constant accelerated observer is going to see some temperature. But of course, this Euclidean argument, you know, is a bit, it's unclear why that works. And tomorrow we'll actually do the calculation to see that that is indeed the right answer. I have to leave off there today.